Hey friends, this is Shadima, also known as the Type A Hippie, and this is the Type A Hippie Podcast, Cheekcast episode. Crap, I always get here and I'm like, what episode are we on? It's episode 28. And I am on with my dear friend. She's like a little sister, Salem Afendiga. Wait, I messed it up. Afangaday. So Salem Afangaday, and she is the principal and she's a founder of the U.S. office of Afangaday Global. She is an attorney and friend. She left Nigeria and came to the U.S. and you did law school here, right?
I did.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And she finished law school at the age of 20. She was not even able to cheers with a legal alcoholic beverage
when she graduated.
That was the hard law school. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, friend.
I'm so glad you're here. So I hope I said this. So this is Cheekcast episode 28, just to get that out there. And so I'm so glad to have you on. We met a long time ago through friends of friends of friends. She's a yogi. She's into essential oils. She's Nigerian as well. She was born in Nigeria. I was born in the States. But we still hold that cultural identity pretty close to us. And I would say we merged into like Nigerian-American. Lots of Nigerians don't like that term. We can get to that later, but that's kind of accurate. And she is, what else? She has her own podcast called Thrive Table Podcast. So I started a social justice book club, and we started in February with one of my dear friends, or two of my best friends. I know that kind of sounds funny because how are two people your best friends? But I have actually even more than that, but that's for another day. Stephanie and Mandy, and we started this social justice book club because we wanted to learn more and have a safe environment, a safe space for people to learn about people that are different than them. And Salem kindly donated 7 books to people, that are part of the group. And so we're so grateful that you are part of it. And thank you for that generous donation. So tell listeners, introduce yourselves to us. Are you on, Salem?
What was your question again?
Did you hear me? Oh, I said introduce yourself to... Okay. So listeners, hold on 1 second. So friends, we're kind of a little under the weather. I'm wearing a onesie and she's like hanging in sweats and a sweatshirt. So if we're a little slower on this podcast, please, space of grace and
mercy. Yes, lots of grace. Lots of grace. No perfection. That's mantra. Right. Grace, not perfection.
That's right.
Yeah, so my name is Salem Afangaday. I am basically everything that Chidimma said kind of comprises a part of what I do. The Thrive Table podcast is my baby right now. It kind of started out as a part of the organization Thrive African Girl when a bunch of my friends and I decided to create the space for African women because we wanted to explore things like feminism and gender and some of the things that we dealt with as African women and create a space for each other to connect and empower, equip, that kind of thing, and host conferences and just do things that are really fun and really cool for African women. And so that started in 2014 while I was still in law school, and it's been going well. And we just kind of decided that we wanted to form another collaborative project out of the Thrive African Girl group. And so another really powerful, really awesome member of the Thrive African Girl group and I decided to start a podcast together. And so that's been a really sweet, really fun space that I've been working to grow right now. In addition, a few months ago, I think 4 months ago now, I started the U.S. office of Afangaday Global. And so, which is a global law firm, we work with people that are starting businesses, nonprofits, and immigrants. And so we love to serve people. We love to really care. That kind of got started out because I had practiced law for about a year before I decided to start my own practice. And I just felt like there was so much resistance to the fact that I actually cared about my clients. I would get so many older attorneys tell me that it wasn't okay to care, that I needed to be ruthless and not care if I wanted to last long term in the practice of law. And so for me, it took a few months of exploring what it would look like to actually care but have boundaries. And when that exploration season was done, I realized that the only way I could go through with that was by starting and building my own law practice. It really wasn't something that I wanted to do, but I think all roads led to that decision. And after praying and seeking for direction and going away and just being in the woods by myself and really just going inward, I really felt like that was the best decision for me, and I just have no regrets. And so it's been a ride, and trying to balance two different industries and also focus on making sure that in this season,
Salam.
Hey,
Hello?
Chidima, are you still there?
Yeah, now I am. I don't know. We lost one another for a second, but.
Okay.
Okay, so you cut out for a second when you said you just feel like this was the best course of action for you. So if you can.
Yeah, so I said that was after reflecting and going away, I felt like having this space where I could build a law practice that was focused on lawyers actually caring for their clients and only working with clients that they felt an alignment with, and just building a practice that was dedicated to caring for clients and caring for self as a holistic being. And that's kind of been what my law firm has been about for the past 4 months since we got started, and it's been a really sweet thing to watch. But also doing that and balancing Thrive African Girl, which is also my big passion and my big baby, while making sure that I'm taken care of and I'm nurturing myself and holistically being the best, most well-rounded version of myself, has been my focus and my passion and the things that I do every day for the past few months, maybe a few years.
I love that. Yeah, no, it's very important. It's like I say to people that are activists as well, that we get to vacillate between self-care and being a thorn in the sides of elected officials, but also educating people, providing spaces where people can get more information about what's happening around them. Speaking of which, when the travel ban that we're supposed to not call a ban was handed down, the executive order that was written that affected seven, namely or mainly Muslim countries, right,
Yes.
came down. You were painstakingly working with clients that were immigrants. Can you kind of walk us through what that looked like and how, what impact it had on you personally as a person who's also an immigrant?
Yeah, so that came down, and I was actually away with like my church community on a retreat that weekend. And so I turned off my phone and I just decided to go away and not really, because the weight of the election and the weight of the things that were happening were still heavy on me. And so I
Sure.
decided to go away and just switch off. And somewhere in between switching off and coming back home, the executive order had been signed. But I just remember turning on my phone again for the first time and getting so many voicemail messages, so many more emails, so many people were just questioning and panicking on my channels, on my, in my inbox, in my messenger. People were reaching out on Facebook who knew that I practiced immigration law, wondering the impact that this had on them, family members, all the way down to people that I didn't know at all that had just found out that I practiced immigration law from the internet. And so I immediately went into, okay, reading the order, seeing what, how, who the order affected, who the order had a capacity to affect in the future, and just immediately started providing pro bono representation to all the people that had reached out. And there were a lot of people. And I think before I could even stop to figure out how I needed to process it for me, I automatically started meeting with people and talking to people, having virtual consultations, and all of that was done pro bono. And so for the whole week after that happened, I suspended meetings with my current clients just to make sure that my immigrant clients and the immigrant population was taken care of in my community, and even other communities who didn't have an immigration lawyer close by. And so I had a lot of virtual consultations. And after realizing that this was not just a quick fix type of thing, that this would be a long-term thing, I reached out to one of my law school professors reached out to me, and she's in charge of the public interest section of our law school, and asked if I needed some help, if she could send me some students that I could train to help with some of these pro bono cases so that they could get public interest hours for the law school. And that just turned out to be really great. I was really hesitant at first because I just didn't think that I had the capacity and the time to train people and to go through the process with other people. And, you know, most of them hadn't taken immigration law, so trying to break everything down to them. But it's just been such an amazing help for me to have them come alongside me, understand the law, reach out to clients, so that all I'm doing for my pro bono clients is just reaching out, talking to them based on the law that I know, and giving them kind of counsel and advice that they don't have to pay for, and how to plan their future immigration statuses based on the executive orders. And so that was a lot of what I did for the past, I think, month now. It's been about a month or a couple of months or 6 weeks maybe. And so I'm gradually getting back into integrating regular parts of my law practice, not just the immigration part of my law practice. But it has been, it was really stressful. And somewhere in the middle of that, I realized that, you know, Nigeria is also a Muslim majority country. And so the personal impact that that could have on my family and my country really hit me somewhere in the middle of that. And so I needed to take time away to process and to, you know, understand what that meant for me, understanding that maybe if Nigeria did get on a future list, I would have to leave, or explore alternative actions for me if that ever came to that. So that was the most frustrating part, just understanding that, you know, you could have this legal status in one day and the next day go back to worrying about your standing in a country.
Yeah.
And reflected with a lot of my clients was really sad and really frustrating.
Yeah, no, I can only imagine. I mean, my parents were born in Nigeria as well, and they are naturalized citizens, and they have been for decades. And so I am extremely grateful. And at the same time, I'm not heartless. You know, I love humanity, and I can only imagine. I remember being in New York City, I believe, or Seattle. I can't remember which one. I think it was New York. And when we first started to hear about Syrian refugees, and I just remember seeing a photograph of people like online on some, a news outlet, like a legitimate news outlet, but their online source. And I just remember people walking. And I broke down in tears because I was like, these are human beings, you know,
yeah.
They're not just people. They're not just random people that want to hurt other people. These are people who are leaving their country of origin. And that is challenging and difficult in and of itself. Like, imagine. Yeah. So listeners, I just want you to, if you are not an immigrant, if you are born and were raised in the same place in the country in which you currently reside, close your eyes for a minute and think about, what if you were forced to leave your country? What if you were forced to leave your country and all you could take was very little, maybe not even photos, let alone clothes or your iPad or your iPhone, like none of that stuff, like just the bare minimum of what you could take that you could literally carry, you know? And imagine if you have children and so pulling them out of school, you know, mm-hmm. You're leaving your job. Like, this is what it looks like for people. So it's not just people just trying to get a free ride in another country. Often, another country that maybe isn't as welcoming to them, and or they don't know the language. Like, so it's not a vacation, you know? So
yeah.
I just want people to understand, and I don't have this lived experience, Salam, you do, what it's like, you know, to do that. So when you have strong opinions against immigration, and most people are not necessarily against immigration reform, there mm-hmm. is rational reasons why we do need to monitor who's coming in and out of this country.
Exactly.
That said, if we look at facts, and I'm going to toss it out there, and I know this isn't a popular view, however, it's the truth and it's not alternative facts. White men are the ones that are committing most of the terrorist attacks here in this country. It is not people from majority Muslim countries. So let's just, I want to face facts and I just want to be clear about that. If you do your research and you're willing to keep an open mind and say, I'm going to just look for facts, rooted in truth, you will come to that as well. So
Yeah.
anyway,
And I think as Christians, like, if we're gonna say that you believe in some kind of higher power or divine power,
that's right.
fear is not, fear of the other, fear of the difference is not a part of that.
That's
Like,
right.
we don't come to the space with fear. We come to the space with love. And if you really believe that love is powerful enough to change things and you really can bank on love rather than banking on fear, that changes everything. That changes what you do, it changes how you do it, it changes policy, it changes reform. And I think sometimes we just become so rooted in the fear. And I think, so many people right now, the current administration really played on fear, and fear is a powerful thing. But if you can
Absolutely.
take the fear blinder off and really, like you said, Chidima, recognizing that these are people, can we just talk about the common humanity of all of us and recognize that common humanity? It changes everything.
Yeah, no, it's so true. And the thing is, to your point, like I, our friend Stephanie has a podcast called Love Activist. Those two are not out of order. You can
Yeah.
have massive amounts of love and still be an activist.
Oh, yeah.
I work my ass off to ensure that people don't feel othered, that people don't feel marginalized, that people feel a part of the conversation, that people know that they're loved. I started to go to Muslim women that I could tell they were Muslim because they're covered, their head covering, wearing hijab, and saying, I just want you to know that I'm really glad that you're here. I don't know you. And I want you to know that everyone in this country does not feel the way the current administration feels. So
Yes.
just know that you are loved, and we may not understand each other very well. We may have some differences of opinion. We may not call our God the exact same thing. However, there are so many similarities between, I would say, three major faiths, not the best faiths, not anything like that. I would
Yeah.
say the three major ones that are most recognized, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, there are many tenets that are very similar amongst those three. And
Yeah.
so if we can draw on those similarities, and it's not to say that differences are bad. I don't necessarily think differences are bad. However, if I'm working or operating out of love, then I'm calling my senator like I did today, and of course her voicemail is full. Debbie Stabenow, clean out your voicemail. Calling you out. So I'm going to email her today. And I'm going to email Gary Peters. These are my senators in Michigan. They are on my speed dial. I
Yeah.
am emailing them because they need to do their damn job. Period. End of story. It's really that simple. But I still love, I have love for them and the work that they do, but I just cannot afford to live in a place of fear. And let the fear overrun us, right? That's not going to happen. So I was listening to your podcast, and we were talking. It was so funny because I actually had my parents listen to some of it. You were talking about secondary school in Nigeria and all of this stuff, So one of the things that I wanted to talk about too today is about like feminism, blackness, and gender, and kind of the intricacies and the intersectionality of color, right? Slash race, and then gender. I remember here in Ann Arbor in high school, I told a boy who happened to be white that I was going to beat him in physics and I was going to score higher than him in physics. And I did. And I wonder if he still remembers. He's actually an attorney
That's funny.
somewhere else, and I won't say the city so that I'll anonymize him. But, I just made that decision and made it happen. I did what I needed to make it happen. So one of the things that I think is interesting is the interplay of culture in terms of Nigerian culture and American culture. And so a lot of times parents in Nigerian culture will say, even if they're raising children in America, they will say something like, "Oh, you can't do it." And that is kind of reverse psychology to make this child fight to do it, right? Or work really
Yes.
hard to do it. Whereas in American culture, that generally doesn't work, and that is considered kind of some sort of abuse, if you will, where
Yeah.
a parent isn't like showing up for their child or supportive of their child, and that is a thing. So what similarities or, differences do you also see, and kind of how did that interplay work? Because friends, if you heard me on during the intro part of this podcast, Salem finished law school at age 20. So that means she had to have skipped multiple grades along the path before she came to the US to even start law school. Because you did law school in 3 years, correct?
Yeah, law school's 3 years. I did undergrad in 3 years as well.
Okay.
And that was here in the US. And so I
Okay.
think my story kind of started with, or well, my story started when I began, but the story of education started kind of, I think, when I was age 7, and my mom had come back from taking, because in Nigeria, you have this entrance exams you're supposed to take before you get from 6th to 7th grade, and it's kind of a national thing. And so my mom had come back from administering a national exam, and she was like, she came back and said, Salem, there were people your age that were taking this exam. You're just playing around. And I was like, oh, I'll take it, next week when it's offered again. So just as kind of a dare thing. And I took it, and I was in first grade at the time, but I was in an accelerated school. So even though I was in our first grade equivalent, I was doing maybe third grade work. And so I took the exam and I did really well. And so I skipped from first grade doing third grade work to 7th grade. And my parents were like, oh, we'll just let you try it out for a year. You're probably going to be horrible at it, and we'll put you back in like 3rd or 4th grade since you've already completed that stuff. So I did, but I did really well. And every year they would say, okay, this year's conditional. However you do will determine whether you go on to the next grade or you stay in this current grade or go back a grade. And I just continued doing that till I graduated from my 12th grade equivalent at age 13. And so we came to the US after that because my mom got a job teaching biology at the university I went to. And they said, if she takes her ACT and does well, she can come. And I went, took the ACT, and I did really well. And so I started university at 14, or college at 14, and didn't really have any friends through college because that 3 years of coming into a new culture, not really understanding cultural things, also added to the fact that I was 14, so like at least 3 years younger than everyone that was there. And I just decided that I wasn't going to focus on making friends. I was just here to get my degree. So I got my degree. I was out of there at 17, went to law school at 17, graduated at 20, and I think that's where the burnout hit. But I think all through that, just seeing, I think the role of my parents was, my dad has always been a very big believer in me. And so he's never really said aloud that he doubted I could do anything. If anything, he's always given me more pressure to push myself further. And while my mom has been more of the, hey, I bet you can't do this kind of parent. And then I'm like, oh, I'm gonna do this to prove to you that I can. And so it's been interesting to see that balance between both of them. And I think my dad definitely has more of the American parent mindset in the sense of, just encourage and encourage and encourage and push further. And my mom is more of the typical Nigerian parent, which is funny because my mom actually spent her childhood years here in America while my dad spent his childhood years in Nigeria. So the first time he came to the US was when we moved in 2008. So, but it's funny to see both of them because my mom is definitely the more traditional Nigerian parent, and my dad is not the most traditional Nigerian parent.
That is so funny. And so your
Yeah.
dad's an attorney as well, correct?
He is. And he, man, he had been taking me to court from age 2. So he would just, I was his little sidekick in court. And I think that was one of the reasons that always made me just know that I wanted to be a lawyer, because he did not look at me and see any limitation. And he would just take me to court with him. And I think he babysat me while my mom worked most of the time. And so I was always, mostly always with him as a child, as far as I can remember, than I was with my mom. And so I love that they kind of broke some of the traditional gender stereotypes,
Mm-hmm.
because we were able, and he would always say about my mom, like, I didn't marry. My mom is such a acts of service person when it comes to the way she shows love. And so I remember all through growing up, my dad, you know, my mom would come back from work and my dad maybe picked us from school and my mom would come back from work and she would go straight to the kitchen and he would call her out to the living room and say, just come sit. Just like, you don't have to cook. I didn't marry a wife. I married a companion. Oh, I didn't marry a cook. I married a companion. And I just like that grew, that stuck in my head as a kid growing up, that woman automatically doesn't equal kitchen. Woman automatically equals companion for as a spouse goes. And so that, I'm really thankful for some of the things that they did, because that those really kind of shaped my idea of feminism, of who I was, of what gender should look like, of what women could do, of what women couldn't do. The answer, nothing, you know, sure. Mm-hmm. So what they taught me.
Yeah, no, I love that, because you were talking about it on the, one of the podcast episodes. So again, friends, it's Thrive Table Podcast, and yes, it's available on iTunes, and I use Overcast. I love that podcast platform. And okay, so it's available there as well. And so one thing you were talking about when you, so one of your classmates, a male classmate, asked you what you wanted to be when you grew up, and you said an attorney, and he said, but who's going to take care of your kids when you're working?
Yeah.
And what's interesting is, you know, like I said, both my parents were born and raised in Nigeria, and my dad came over first, actually, and he started school, and then he got funding to go to U of M. So he got a full ride, essentially. And so he earned 2 masters and a PhD at the University of Michigan, the only U of M. By the way, friends, by the way. So
that's typical Nigeria, though.
Totally. Right. And so we lived in family housing initially, you know, and then moved into homes and stuff like that. But I'll tell you, my mom would take care of the checkbook. So she would like write out the checks. She would write out the bills. And I always assumed that that's what mothers do.
Yeah.
I never knew any different. I didn't know that in a lot of homes, men actually take care of the finances. I did not know that, because whomever is better at whatever, that's takes ownership of whatever, you know? So yeah, my dad also cooked. My mom cooks really well, but my dad does too. And so he would cook, he would care for the children, he would clean the house. You know, there was never a delineation by gender and supposed, I'm putting in quotes, gender roles. Because, you know, many people, and so friends that are listening, we are using gendered language. This is not meant to exclude anyone. Yeah. This is all about inclusion. So, you know, having been raised in a home where I had one mother who's cisgender woman, you know, and a father who's cisgender male. So I didn't know that other homes were different. I always assumed that what I knew growing up was what was, you know, that's what the norm was. And to your point, there was never an issue of what I could do versus what my brothers could do. I would say that the one time that there was something questionable was when my brother moved to Las Vegas. And I can't even say with 100% certainty, I don't know how my parents really felt about it, but I know that my parents were not thrilled that I was moving to Las Vegas. And I think the only thing that they were okay with that scenario is that I had a brother that was already living there. And so one of my younger brothers actually had moved there 5 months before I did in 2006. So I think that set their mind slightly at ease. Because they had just watched a documentary. So my dad was a professor. He's retired now, but he also has been a pastor for a really long time. And so they watched a documentary, him and my mom, and it was like called like Las Vegas Sin City or whatever. And so they were just kind of like, did you know they call that place Sin City? I'm like, I am aware, you know, and I'm still going. So, you know, it's always been like education has always been important in our family. And so, like, I have a master's degree. My brother is an attorney as well. He got a full ride to University of Michigan Law School. My sister got 2 masters at U of M, and one is in structural engineering and one is in architecture. So she's an architectural engineer. And then my other two brothers that didn't go to school, or they started school, but they didn't ever like kind of complete, read a lot. So they're some of the most intelligent people that I've ever met. And then my mom went back at in her 50s and got her PhD. So, I mean, there was never a, okay, this is the limit, or you really need to focus on getting married and having children. That was not ever the focus in our family. It was always, how do you contribute as a human being? And who are you? Because my mom always said character. She always says character is beauty. So, like, who are you in terms of your character? And also, there is that component, that cultural component, right? So it's like there are certain things that are acceptable and unacceptable. And so, in terms of Nigeria, and they also didn't even play into the, because many Nigerians feel that there are only three reputable
Professions.
professions: attorney, medical
Doctor.
doctor, and engineer. And so they didn't necessarily even play into that. They did not play into that. I shouldn't say necessarily. They did not play into that. Same thing with they didn't play into traditional gender roles and or you know, what I was relegated to do as a woman compared to my brothers as men. So and it was really cool that the first book that we started with was by a Nigerian author, Chidimamanda, and what We Should All Be Feminists was the book. And so she explored different ideas about that as well, like what does feminism look like, and you know, what we as a culture, so not just Nigerian culture but American culture, can do to help support this idea of people being people rather than being relegated to particular gender roles and or kind of this notion or idea of can't, like what's not possible, and instead looking at what's possible. So you read the book, I read the book because we did it for this book club, and I'd read it prior to, and I'm sure you had as well. What did you think, and what kind of resonated with you in that? And what, I guess, what didn't, if anything, did not resonate with you?
I don't think there was anything that I read and said, oh, I don't like that Chimamanda said this. I love the way she broke feminism down. I love the way she gave really practical examples. I think if there was one thing that resonated with me, it was the idea of the last name. I think that's where she talks about the last name. Does she talk about the last name in that one as well?
I don't think so, but I think I've read an article about that.
Yeah, because she's coming out with a new book with that second article. With the second manifesto for feminism. But so I guess both of them are blurred in my head. But in that second one, she talks about how if you're not, there's no point to what's the reason behind expecting a woman to take on the man's last name. If it's all about creating a new identity, then why don't they both take on a complete a third party last name? But just shattering that societal expectation that, hey, women are supposed to take on their husband's last name, and that's all cultural. Like, that's not, there's no real reason for doing that. And I think that's something that, because every woman in my family took their husband's last name. They may have hyphenated, but their husband's last name was still a part of their name. And for me, from like being very little, I've always been so attached to my last name in a way that nobody else got in any way. And so reading that from Chimamanda just really gave me a sense of, oh, this is why. And my last name means path of courage. And you know, my name is Salem, which means peace. So like peace on the path of courage has kind of always been my mantra. And so I'm so attached, so connected to my last name, so connected to my name as it is. And I just don't think that I've always said I'd never want to take on someone else's last name. And so that just bringing up that idea and exploring it, and I took it up with my parents because I said, hey, you know, this is what Chimamanda says. They know I read a lot of Chimamanda. And it was interesting to gauge their perceptions. I think my dad was like, oh, that's cool. My mom was like, but no, I took on your dad's last name. You know, you should too. And I'm like, sorry, mom, I don't think I will. But it just opened up an opportunity for a discussion on something that I think traditionally everyone just kind of does it because everyone else does it. And so that was something that really stood out to me that I really enjoyed and appreciated. But I love Chimamanda's, and the inclusion of feminism, you know, doesn't have to look like her feminism. It doesn't have to look like Beyonce's feminism. Like, it can just be feminism.
Right. Yeah,
Feminism
no.
equals
Yeah.
equality.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I love Chimamanda as well because she has her voice and she's clear that it's her voice, you know. And so there's not because I think sometimes what happens is people also shame others with their brand or their version. And it's like if I choose to take on my husband's last name, then there's a problem. If I choose to work or if I choose to stay home, then really I'm not a feminist like someone who is working and also raising children, right? And so one of the problems that I see in the political climate is that there's an obsessiveness, there's an obsessive desire to control other people and to dictate what the narrative is. And it's like my life choice really has absolutely nothing
Nothing to do
to
with
do
you.
with you.
No.
So please, for the love of God and all things holy, mind your damn business, is what I
Yes.
like to say to people. You know, whether I choose to utilize birth control or not, it really has no bearing on your life or your family's life. So why are you even concerning yourself and inserting yourself into this conversation? You know, and I ran into that a lot when I was posting. I started posting more politically, and I have gotten people have attempted to shame my faith, and really have done and said hurtful things to me. People that I've known for 10 years, you know, people that I've not ever had disagreement with for 10 years. And it's been interesting to me, and these are so-called Christians, like people who have a faith, and even if it's not a Christian brand faith, it they have a faith and a power that's greater than themselves. So they have some measure of spirituality according to themselves. And so it's not something that I'm seeing, you know, because why are you coming here to fight with me on my Facebook page? That doesn't make any sense, especially when I'm not even posting anything that really has anything to do with your own specific life as a male because you're not on birth control. You know? So, I do like that she has found ways to include everyone. And I love one thing. So, I posted on our so friends, if you want to get in on the social justice book club, it's called hashtag Hope Rising Online Book Club.
It's interesting. I recommend it, friends.
Yeah, it's really good. It's good discussion. It's not always everyone is in agreement, which is good, but it's a safe space to learn and be still and be quiet and just hear something different than what you've known. And so she talks about teaching girls to reject likability. And I've had people say, well, you're just so direct. And I'm like, yes. And you would much rather me be direct than anything else because that's the only way I know how to be. Now, my loving life coach does say that truth without compassion is brutality. So I will not beat someone over the head with the truth because I don't think that's kind. However, I will say what needs to be said in a loving, kind, tolerant way. And if you don't like it, then that's really on you. If I've done what I can on my side of the street to deliver the information in a way that is kind and respectful, and you don't like it, then you just don't like the message. That is not a me problem. That is a you problem, you
And
know?
you, and that's where you sit with yourself and say, okay, like, if you're a self-awareness person,
Totally.
what is it in me that's causing a resistance to this? Rather than attacking, you sit with yourself and say, okay, like, why am I resistant to this idea? Why is it that when she posts about birth control, it really bothers me? Why is it, you know, like, if you're actually trying to grow, that's where you go. But if you kind of see that and like shame yourself or cut yourself off from her or, you know, from anybody else that presents a different perspective than you, then you're not really ready to grow.
That's
And
right.
that's okay. Like having that grace for yourself and saying, hey, you know, I'm not really ready to grow in this. Because I think the more grace you have for yourself, the more grace you can have for other people. I think the reason that we don't have a lot of loving people in the world is that they don't know how to love themselves.
Yep.
And so they just project their self-hate and everything that's within on other people. I strongly believe that because I think my capacity to love others has exponentially grown through my capacity to love myself.
Yep.
Which is
That's
kind
true.
of, you know, I think it's written somewhere in the good book, something about that, love others the way you love yourself.
Yep.
So I think it's really interesting that that's actual truth. That is the when you're able to project self-hate, hate onto other people, that's just a reflection of your self-hate.
Totally. My mom used to say that when people would apologize to her, she said, "You're apologizing to yourself," because, and I never understood that. And then, and she would graciously accept it, of course, you know. So now I say that when people are really nasty to me and then they come around and they apologize, I accept it. And at the same time, I generally add, "Well, you did that to yourself. So who you were really angry with at the time that you lashed out at me was not really me, because this is not a me issue. And I won't own that, you know. So it was really yourself. And it just looked like you were angry with me, but it wasn't personal, you know. Because so many people, you know, they lack some self-awareness, or they don't have people in their lives that will shut it down. Like the current administration, they don't have one another's back, truly. Because if you did, someone would be like, "No, this is not acceptable." Or, "This is unacceptable. We cannot proceed this way." And they would shut it down. But that's not what's happening, you know? The other thing, one more thing, and then we probably have to wrap up, even though we could probably talk for
a really long time.
She mentioned feminism light and how the British Prime Minister said that her husband allowed her to shine. You know, and so this notion of allow, which connotes power, you know, and kind of like what that looks like, because even your dad never said anything like that. He said, it sounds like he said, you know, "My intention when I married you was to have a companion, a partner, someone equal, not someone that you could dominate." You know, and so what are your thoughts on that? And then we will wrap up, sadly.
You know, I think that is so powerful, because I think we, even some people that are feminists, we still hold on to this ideal of, because we've been raised in such a patriarchal culture, we don't even, sometimes we don't even recognize when we're buying into masculine energy being the dominant force. And I, like, I've noticed that, even though I would say, I'll take it a step further, even though I would say that I'm a pretty big feminist, I still count the success of my day based on how much I've done, based on my productivity factor, versus something more feminine energy associated, like my happiness factor or my connection factor or other things that I've done in my day that have brought joy and evoked positive emotion. I still, in the back of my head, still think that productivity trumps pleasure. And that's something I'm working on within myself. That's a space that I'm coming to. But I think that feminism likes, as a result of saying, thinking that we know all we need to know about feminism based on a book that we've read, or based on based on one incident that we had where we felt like we were able to get a high position of power. And so we don't understand and we don't recognize the ways that this dominant male culture is proceeding and still internalizes and plays that within us. I think, you know, you had mentioned something about likability. I think that's a big one, because women are constantly taught to be likable. And even within marriage, like, it's always about, you never really see articles when you're reading about, you know, marriage articles or relationship articles about how to, as a man, to make a woman, like how to please a woman or how to make a woman happy within a relationship. Those articles are so less compared to the articles that you see about women learning how to make men happy or how to please men, how to attract men. Like, those are things that we don't recognize because we don't really understand and see how this dominant masculine culture plays a role within us internally. And so I just think once your eyes are open and once you're aware and you stay attentive and you just want to stay open and you want to keep learning, you see things like feminism light. You see things like women saying, "Oh, you know, it was so gracious of my husband to keep the kids today. Keep the kids, they're his kids." Like, what?
Thank you. It's not called babysitting when you're the father.
Exactly.
Just to know. And it's the same thing I feel across the board too, right? It's like, "Well, I've never been to jail." You're not supposed to go to jail. That is not a prerequisite for living. I take care of my kids. I pay child support. Well, that's what you're supposed to do. If you're not living in the home, then you should contribute financially.
Exactly.
And hopefully, if you're a safe person, you will also contribute emotionally by seeing your children. You know, I don't
Exactly.
understand. It's like a rationalization, like give me a high five or give me a pat on the back for doing what I'm
What
supposed to
should
be
you?
doing.
Yeah, you don't get a cookie for that. And I
Right.
think it's the same with racism. You know, people are like, oh, you know, like I did this today looking for approval. You know, I went to a march. Okay, great. Like you should have been doing that a long time ago. It's
Sure.
great that you did, but you don't really get an affirmation or an approval for doing what it's part of your civic duty
Right.
as a member of
Exactly.
the country, as a member of a collective. And again, it goes back to we can really look at the why behind what we're doing. It's likability, the root of, as women, it's likability, the root of why we're doing what we're doing. Because when we get to that point that likability truly doesn't matter and you really can be true and authentic to the divine within you, and you go forth from that place, it doesn't matter who approves. It doesn't matter if you're too intimidating to guys because you're doing this. It doesn't matter, you know, what other people think of you. All that matters is you're following what you know to be true within.
Yeah, no, it's true. Okay, so next time we're gonna talk about dating
Yes.
as an activist. That's just so friends, be on the lookout for that because I have so much more that I want to add and it relates to that. But we'll keep you in suspense. So, Salem, thank you so much for participating on this podcast and lending your voice and adding your voice, that's just an amazing one to this
Oh.
discussion. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. I love talking to you. I feel like this is just, it felt more like a conversation, like you said,
Totally. That's
conversation
what,
with a friend.
right? That's what we do. So, friends, I flipped open to our favorite book, Humans of New York, The Stories, and there is a person, and I cannot tell, all I can see is their race, but it says, "I'm drawing the man who raped me." So this person is drawing a picture of the person that sexually assaulted them. And then another guy, he looks like a Vietnam vet by his hat, and he has a cigarette that's lit. And it says, "Saddest moment? Question mark. How am I supposed to choose between losing my parents and seeing my friends die in Vietnam? I don't categorize those things. Listen, a person is like a rubber band ball. We've all got a lot of bad rubber bands and a lot of good rubber bands. And they're all wrapped up together. And you've got to have both types of bands or your rubber band ball is ain't gonna bounce. And no use trying to untangle them. You know what I'm saying?" And then the last one is, "I want to go back to my island. I came from St. Lucia when I was a teenager, and it's been hard. Things are different here. Back home, everyone is always helping each other. Everybody asks, 'How are you?' and 'How can I help?' Here, unless you have family or good friends, you're on your own. I lived my whole life as an undocumented citizen. Everything was against me. I worked for less than a minimum wage, no benefits. When things were very tough, I took my son to try to get government aid, and they turned me away because I didn't have a social security number. Everyone in line could hear. I was so humiliated." This woman is asked, "What are your happiest memories from St. Lucia?" Her response, "Being a kid, sitting in a tree with my brother, eating fruit, and daydreaming about going to America."
Wow.
Right? So, all right. "I honor the place within you where the entire universe resides. I honor the place within you of love, of light, of truth, of peace. I honor the place within you where when you are in that place in you and I'm in that place in me, there is only one of us." So, friends, thanks so much for your support. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a grace-filled day. Do something amazing for yourself and your community. I will share with you how you can reach out to Salem in the show notes. And until then, my name is Shadima, the Type A hippie. Namaste.